Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. Or you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt. And this is Bookworm. Today I have the pleasure of talking to John Ashbery, the translator of a volume of Pierre Martori's poetry, The Landscapist, published by the Sheep Meadow Press. It's a dual language edition in English and French. I encountered Martori's poetry in a little magazine around 10 years ago. It was a magazine called Oblique. And I found it enchanting. In fact, I couldn't wait to find more. Over the years, there have been chapbooks, then a volume, and now this, The Landscapist, is the completest volume of his work to be translated by John Ashbery. Now, it's my belief that among the ways we know and understand a poet is by the work he chooses to translate. And the involvement with Martori's work, as well as with Martori, has been lifelong for Ashbery. In fact, this volume was nominated by the National Book Critics Circle Award as a nominee for poetry, not for translation, a volume of poetry. That's how good the translations are and how extraordinary the poems are. John Ashbery met Martori in Paris when he first went there on a Fulbright. What year was that, John?
I met him in the spring of 1956.
And I'm curious, this is an interview with Ashbery, who is my favorite living poet. And it is as much about your work as about Martori's. What was French poetry for you when you went to Paris in 1956?
Well, I arrived in the fall of 55. I really didn't know French very well at that point, so much of it remained totally below my radar. I had read translations of Rimbaud, René Char, Verlaine, etc. But I couldn't really read it in the original. And my project, for which you had to have in order to get a Fulbright, was to do a sort of an anthology of 20th century French poetry in translation. I sort of did that, actually, although it never published most of the results. And but as I say, it was still terra incognita, mostly, for me.
Was it, you had a taste for French poetry, though. Had you studied it at Harvard?
No, I studied French in high school, actually for about 4 years, and in high school at Harvard, I didn't take any French literature courses, but I read Proust when I was an undergraduate in English, of course, and I always was attracted by things French, as so many of us are. I read French fairy tales when I was a child, Perrault, etc. And it always seemed as though that was the place of romance and pageantry and all the things one wants.
In fact, I'm hoping that listeners we'll discover a good number of things to read, and I want to mention the French fairy tale that you translated in a book called Wonder Tales that Marina Warner edited.
Yes.
A very beautiful fairy tale. Now, can you then say what you thought French poetry would be before you encountered it?
There would be an element of surrealism in it, obviously, because that's where surrealism began. And I had read some surrealist poetry in translation by Henri Breton, Paul Éluard. And in America, or in America and England, there wasn't really any tradition like that. And I was attracted to surrealist painting even when I was taking children's art classes at the local museum, and wondered why there couldn't be something like that in poetry. And but the few attempts in English in the early 20th century were not really very exciting, and so.
For me, and I think people, I remember that in the late 60s, we were reading The Banquet Years, which had very good chapters on Jarry, Apollinaire, and Satie,
mm-hmm.
and made the work irresistible. Dada and surrealism seemed so much more fun than what yeah. was going on in American poetry,
yeah.
and mysterious and funny as well. And I remember someone got a copy of Eric Satie's play, Le Piège de Méduse, and started doing an impromptu translation for me. And I was so amused and entertained by it because it had elements of farce and mystery, theft, yeah. heist, all of it punctuated by dances by a mechanical monkey who lurked at the side of the stage and performed certain jigs, tarantellas, extraordinary pieces, all of them less than 60 seconds long by Satie. So that fascination with brevity seems a part of it too. And also something I know that Pierre Martory had a fascination with popular song entering poetry. It's there in Apollinaire. Irving Berlin enters some of the songs by Eric Satie. In particular, I think that mysterious rag is part of his ballet Parade. All these things make it seem almost like, with its interest in music hall and burlesque, something that would be beloved by Americans. Why do you suppose that there wasn't, and until really you, isn't an American tradition derived from the French poetry?
I don't know, really. Of course, Frank O'Hara is certainly another person who would be influenced by those things. And in fact, it was he who first sort of turned me on to the music of Satie, for example. There wasn't very much recorded back in those, in the days when I first met him, which was in 1949. And he could play the piano, and he also wrote music himself, and he would play pieces by Satie so that I could get an idea of what they were like.
Now, you speak in the introduction to The Landscapist of Martory's fondness for the novels of Raymond Queneau, which you speak of, or you suspect there's a fondness for Queneau, which you speak of as a palliative for the overly existential novels of Camus and Sartre. And there is in the work, rather than angst, the thing that Satie loved, melancholy.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that he's a great and beautiful practitioner of a comic melancholy, which stems in many cases from childhood. I want you to read his mother poem, and we'll talk from there. This is John Ashbery reading a poem by Pierre Martory from The Landscapist.
Yes, the title is, I left the title in French. It's Ma chandelle est morte, which is a line from the famous nursery rhyme Au clair de la lune, mon ami Pierrot. It means my candle is dead or my candle has gone out. My mother's bedroom has flowered wallpaper, wallpaper with paper flowers. My mother will abort a black and red prince, a gnome with a hair lip. A thousand blue and yellow stripes delight my wakings. I remain the handsomest, the wisest. I remain the best of my mother's sons. And my mother, with her profile drawn on the wall, has gone out early to drink absinthe, or buy bread, or wash my underpants, or sell my underpants and hers to no one. Mouse with red cheese, time is passing. Mouse, my gray sister, you speak with your nails. A hole hides a trap, an evening hides a day. A morning is never anything but a tired evening. Of this day, too much like the day beyond the window.
John Ashbery reading an early poem, I believe, by Pierre Martory.
Most of them don't have dates. I think that probably dates from the early 1950s, before I knew him.
Now, tell me, where and how did you meet?
We met in a cafe at Saint-Germain-des-Prés, and we were introduced by a literary critic who was rather well known at the time, who I'd met a few weeks before.
Who was that?
His name
yes.
was Henri L. H-E-L-L.
A French literary critic.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And, you know, you'll pardon me, but when I look at the pictures, there are two in the book, he's adorable. I mean, he just looks so charming. And in your introduction, you mentioned that the poet Anne Lauterbach, who'd met him, had found him as if he was literally a spellcaster. And I sense that this is true from a little piece that Dara Wire wrote about one of his poems in a collection about overlooked poems. Can you describe the spell that he cast?
I'm not sure he was aware of it. He was extremely shy, among other things, but also quite, he could be very impertinent on short notice. Part of his charm, certainly for his American friends, of which he had quite a few, was his accented English, which was slightly German. I think he learned German in school before he learned English. So his French had a slightly German, in fact, slightly Yiddish accent.
Can you imitate?
What?
Can you imitate him?
We'd say things like, I don't need it, for I don't need it. I mean, that's an exaggeration, and he didn't have as strong an accent as that, but... And he also used German constructions in English, which came out very charmingly.
Now, I hear that at this time, you write back to friends in America about the number of movies you're seeing and how, really, the movement of movie images should influence poetry is, you know, fantastic to the poetry. Did you go to the movies with him? Were you at his side?
Yes, we went often several times a week, usually to American movies in the original language at the big movie houses on the Champs-Élysées. mainly because I was sort of homesick for America, and Beard just liked any American movie. And so I remember we saw, I don't know why it comes back to me, I remember seeing The Revolt of Mamie Stover with Jane Russell on the Champs-Élysées. And I turned around at some point and noticed sitting behind me the famous movie actor Jean Marais, who was Jean Cocteau's lover and starred in his films. It seems strange that all of us should be there now, for Jane Russell.
It seems to me that everything becomes in some way strange for you there in Paris, that the language is not American, that you're translating, you're writing poems in French and translating them into English as if your own language were a foreign language, seeing American films, and not only American films, but I've got the sense that he liked American musicals. You mentioned that he saw Reveille with Beverly in Morocco. And I know that you once told me about how much you liked The Great Gildersleeve. It must have been a very interesting form of Americanism there in Paris, learning and writing French poetry to do an anthology. You are editing what I still take to be one of the best literary magazines and art magazines that ever existed, Arts and Literature, with some of the most fantastic translations. I think the first translation of Bachelard, the first translation of a section of de Chirico's novel Hebdomeros, many of these translations by you. It seems like a very fertile period, and yet you say in this introduction that you rarely spoke to one another about your work. I'm very curious about this. Would you say you shared a sensibility rather than talking about poetry itself?
Yes, I think that's it. I still don't talk about poetry with my friends or with anybody, really, if I can avoid it, mm-hmm. which I obviously can't always do. But on the other hand, there certainly was discussion of things poetic among us. In fact, Pierre did some early translations of poems of mine when we first met, and I didn't know, my French wasn't good enough at that point to translate him or even to really judge the quality of his work. That only came a few years later. It took me quite a long time, really, to get fluent in French.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with John Ashbery, translator of The Landscapist by Pierre Martory, published by Sheep Metal Press, really talking about his years in Paris, his years on a Fulbright, and I think the crucial development years of Ashbery's own work will continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with John Ashbery about the French poet Pierre Martory. How long were you lived with him? Around 10 years, I think.
From the spring of 56, shortly after we first met, until the fall of 65, at the November 65, when I moved back to America. We didn't always live together, but there were periods when we lived apart, but mostly we did.
Now, I'm very interested. At a certain point in his life, after publishing one novel and having a second rejected, and a third which he was asked to change the ending of and decided that he would not publish rather than changing the ending. He does not publish in France. The work is secret and rarely shared. So it's not just your translations. You are creating Pierre Martiri as a poet. Yes?
Well, possibly, yeah.
You know, for a public, yeah. You know. And this has been an act of creation that's gone on for many years. Before I knew you, I would see these translations and wonder sometimes if Martiri existed. he seemed too good to be true. and I wonder, now we have a really beautiful full-length book, and I want to hear a poem that I think is extraordinarily beautiful, nonsensical, and haunting, called Litanies.
Litanies. May it please the shower of gold to cover me, for I am cold from soft metal. May it please the shower of gold to cover me, for I am cold from soft metal. May it please the shower of water to cover me, for I have faith of metamorphosis. May it please the shower of water to cover me, for I have faith of metamorphosis. May it please the harsh idea to nourish me, for I thirst after my false loves. May it please the harsh idea to nourish me, for I thirst after my false loves. May it please the afternoon to suffice me, for I've had too much of my dark days. May it please the afternoon to suffice me, for I've had too much of my dark days. May it please the near here to open for me, for I've knocked at its door in vain. May it please the near here to open for me, for I've knocked at its door in vain. May it please the calm sea to swell, for I've trapped too many sea lice. May it please the calm sea to swell, for I've trapped too many sea lice. May it please the incarnate soul to show itself, for I have believed in the incarnate soul. May it please the incarnate soul to show itself, for I have believed in the incarnate soul. May it please the closed fist to show itself, for I have drawn the rusty blade. May it please the closed fist to show itself, for I have drawn the rusty blade. May it please the lover, the loved, to lie to itself, for I have known the weight of the lie. May it please the lover, the loved, to lie to itself, for I have known the weight of the lie. May it please the man in tears to bruise himself, I've howled the cry of my dreams. May it please the man in tears to bruise himself, I've howled the cry of my dreams.
John Ashbery reading Litanies by Pierre Martiri. Now, that seems to me to be a particularly beautiful,
yeah,
exquisite, and sad,
yes,
poem. And yet it still partakes, I guess, of what I call an overtone of nonsense because of the religious litany sense.
Yeah.
There's something of your old Father William, you know, the, you know, suddenly something is being stood on its head and the impulse to prayer,
yeah,
is turning into something personal,
yeah,
and entirely heartbroken.
Yeah. Yeah. He claimed not to be religious, but I've wondered at that line, may it please the incarnate soul to reveal itself, for I have believed in the incarnate soul. I never really believed that he had abandoned the religion that he grew, the Roman Catholic religion that he grew up with, although he insisted that he had.
Now, I'm curious. You have a long poem called Litany. How to work the question... does it bear relation to the religious aspect of litany? In a sense, this poem does. In any rate, its beauty convinces one that he hasn't abandoned the possibility that a litany, that a prayer, that repetition offer.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering that about your own work, if you don't mind answering.
I think it's a sheer coincidence that the titles are the same. I'm not sure I had read this poem at the time I wrote my poem, because a lot of these poems were I found in his papers after his death. But yes, your question.
The impulse to write something called litany,
yeah.
Is it in some way, in what way might it be a religious impulse?
Well, I am an occasional church goer and have been exposed to the great litany and Episcopal service. And then there's, of course, the other meaning of litany. There's some tiresome list. His litany of complaints, for instance.
Yes.
I think I meant both of those things.
We're in your room here in Hudson, New York, and there are pictures of Pierre around that you've shown me. Do you find yourself missing him a great deal?
Yes, I do, actually. I think about him a lot and wish that his life had been happier, because I don't think it was. I tried to make it as happy as possible, and I, in fact, discovered several years ago now that an unfinished memoir that he wrote, about only about 10 pages long, which I'm intending to translate at some point, and he had scribbled the title on top, "Ne m'oubliez pas." Don't forget me. And so I've been trying to take that seriously.
Thank you. I've been speaking with John Ashbery, the translator of The Landscapist, a book of poems by Pierre Martory, both in English and in French, published by Sheep Metal Press. Thank you, John, for joining me.
Thank you.
You can podcast this program, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog with the click of a button on our new media player at kcrw.com. My co-producer is Melinda Siegel. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones from our website. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm. Plus copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.